TC.
It is Monday, May the 30th. This is VOA's International Edition. Thanks for joining us. Coming up, what's happening to the Islamic State if they lose Fallujah?
They could disappear pretty quickly, or they could dig in and be almost impossible to fight out.
New wrinkle for the Syrian peace talks, plus honoring America's fallen soldiers.
It warms your heart to be able to do this for them and to honor them, and I think it's something that everyone should get to experience.
And something new, an Indian song and dance. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. The fight against the Islamic State is being pursued on three fronts right now. Iraqi security forces have surrounded Fallujah ahead of a full-scale offense. Fallujah has been held by IS longer than any other city in Iraq. Also, Iraq's autonomous Kurdish region has announced the launch of an offensive involving 5,500 Peshmerga fighters to retake an area on the road between its capital, Erbil, and the city of Mosul. And in Syria, Kurdish rebels from the People's Protection Units, the YPG, allied to Arab fighters and backed by a U.S.-led coalition, are targeting Raqqa, the Islamic State's de facto Syrian capital. For some perspective on all of this, VOA's Victor Beatty speaks with former U.S. Ambassador to Iraq, James Jeffrey. Ambassador Jeffrey compares the current campaign in Fallujah with the 2004 so-called Operation Phantom Fury, in which U.S. Marines fought to retake the city from the Iraqi insurgency.
The Fallujah campaign, the main campaign, when the Marines crossed the line and entered the city from the north, and I was actually Marines, and about a third of the forces were U.S. Army. That took about a week to basically fight their way through the city. There were probably 2,000 al-Qaeda elements in Fallujah at that time. I don't think there are that many now, but we're talking about, you know, the better part of a division of elite U.S. troops with all kinds of firepower that the Iraqis, even with U.S. air support, cannot dream of. You know, very accurate artillery, attack helicopters, this kind of thing. Again, it depends on if ISIS decides that they'll stand and fight, and if they've got enough forces in there, this could be a very long and tough battle.
Are the Peshmerga up to putting this pressure on Mosul eventually to retake it, and how long do you think that'll take?
Well, the Peshmerga would be, and this is a problem also with the YPG forces in Syria. Kurdish forces are not going to venture very far outside largely Kurdish areas without a lot of U.S. support, more than just some special forces teams. You know, it's one of the many reasons I argue for at least some U.S. combat forces, because if American troops are on the ground, they basically sort of reassure everybody, at least in the short run, that, you know, another ethnic force isn't going to take over and ethnically cleanse you and stuff, and that's part of the reason for the Kurds. But the Kurds also don't want to have their troops die for territory they didn't have to turn over to somebody else. And they also are well aware that people will suspect that they're trying to seize more territory. Now, some of the areas where the Kurds are moving forward, Peshmerga in northern Iraq, are areas that have traditionally been under their control or contain a high percent of Kurds. And for that matter, East Mosul was traditionally a significant Kurdish area where the Kurdish Peshmerga always had, up until 2014, a significant security presence. So they could be capable of doing East Mosul. But East Mosul was never the center of al-Qaeda, and it isn't the center of ISIS. That's West Mosul. That's the bulk of the city, and that's where the real fighting is going to be.
The Islamic State, how badly on the defensive is it at this point? Will it take a year to retake these cities?
Nobody knows. The U.S. military... it has been, in the last couple of days, more pessimistic than I've heard in the last couple of weeks. The president was very pessimistic in his last comments during his travels to Europe about how he doesn't see Mosul and Raqqa falling in his administration. But then the military, based upon some success, was talking without specific times, but certainly that momentum was on their side. In the last couple of days, they've been basically warning people off a bit. So we don't know. The problem is, you saw this with the Iraqi army. In 2014, suddenly the thing just melted away in Mosul and most of the Sunni areas of Iraq. You saw the same thing with the Taliban 2001. And frankly, with the surge, you know, once you got the awakening going, I mean, I was in Iraq in early 2007 with Secretary Gates, and it was like the Battle of the Somme with incoming and outgoing artillery every night. Well, within 7 months, we had basically beaten the entire Sunni insurgency, which was primarily an al-Qaeda insurgency by that time. It had melted away and became the terrorist force that we knew until 2014. So the nature of war in these conflicts, be it Iraq, Afghanistan, elsewhere, look how quickly the Israelis fought their wars. Look how fast we did the first Gulf War. Look what happened to the Iraqi army in 2003. Typically, forces melt away suddenly in a way that we're just not used to from, you know, fighting in World War One and World War Two on the Western Front or even the Eastern Front. It's a different dynamic. And so they could disappear pretty quickly, or they could dig in and be almost impossible to fight out. We never did fully conquer Sa'da City in 2008, although we mounted a very, very extensive campaign. So I can cite you examples where people can dig in and hold out forever, or where they surrender, or not surrender, but where they fade away pretty quickly. We're in an environment where we don't know how quickly this is going to happen, but the momentum is definitely on the side of the various forces on the three fronts.
James Jeffrey is a former U.S. ambassador to Iraq, currently a fellow at the Washington Institute of Near East Policy. He was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. The Syrian opposition's chief negotiator in the stalled UN-brokered peace talks, Mohammed Al-Loush, has announced his resignation, citing the failure of the Geneva negotiations and the continued shelling of rebel-held areas by President Bashar al-Assad's regime. For some insight on whether this might harm the peace talks, VOA spoke with Trinity University scholar David Lesh.
I think it's an inevitable result of what really has been a piecemeal breaking apart of the peace effort ever since its high point in late February when the Russians announced and the U.S. announced a cessation of hostilities, which in actuality didn't last all that long. They kept trying to put Band-Aids to it to keep some semblance of a process together, but it is inevitably falling apart. Partly due to the fact that you know, the regime has made gains over the last number of months with Russian and Iranian support, so really they're in no mood to negotiate. They feel they don't have to negotiate or make the necessary concessions, at least from the point of view of the opposition. And the opposition, you know, certainly the High Negotiation Committee, certainly many elements of the High Negotiation Committee, they must be very, very frustrated right now because they really don't have a military option to speak of against the Assad regime. But on the other hand, you know, the powers that be, particularly the United States and Russia, seem to be focused more on the jihadist groups, Jabhat al-Nusra, and particularly the Islamic State. And, you know, for better or worse, even the United States, I think, has made the calculation that the Assad regime is a necessary evil for the time being. So this is not surprising to me at all. It is a blow to the process, but, you know, it's a process that's been unraveling for a number of weeks now.
David Lesh is a professor of history at Trinity University, also the author of numerous books, including Syria, The Fall of the House of Assad from Yale University Press. This last round of Syrian peace talks in Geneva reached a deadlock in April when the High Negotiations Committee suspended its participation over an escalation of fighting on the ground. The UN Peace Envoy for Syria, Staffan de Mistura, says he has no plans to convene another round of talks in the next 2 or 3 weeks. Among the top stories we're following here on The Voice of America, the Hajj pilgrimage in jeopardy for Iranians, slain Pakistani driver's family initiating some legal action against U.S. officials, plus West Africa better prepared to contain a future outbreak of Ebola. Expanded coverage of these stories and a lot more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. Nelson Mandela's estate is finally being settled nearly 3 years after his death, as his executors in Johannesburg have handed out inheritance checks. VOA's Anita Powell reports the story, however, far from over as a legal battle continues over his rural homestead.
The happy and grateful heirs who collected inheritance checks on Friday, among them a former driver, a gardener, and a housekeeper, made it appear that Nelson Mandela's $3 million estate is being disbursed amicably. The estate's main executor, Dihang Moseneke, beamed as lawyers handed checks to household staff and leaders from schools the late South African president attended. Mandela also left money to his widow, all of his surviving children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren. Most of those funds were electronically distributed this week, executors said. Moseneke disputed media reports that the will had caused family squabbles.
Despite all the speculations we found and seen so often in the media, there was no fight within the family. The family was united. They gave us support and something that was totally befitting the stature of Mr. Mandela and the love they owed to him and the love he had for all of the family.
The retired Deputy Chief Justice may be technically correct. That's because the Mandela relative who is challenging executors has been effectively excluded since his death, both from his will and, to some extent, his family. Mandela, who was so widely admired for urging forgiveness after spending most of his life fighting South Africa's racist apartheid regime, bequeathed nothing to his second wife, Winnie Madikizela Mandela. The pair remained married throughout Mandela's 27-year prison spell for his opposition to apartheid. They divorced in 1996 during Mandela's term as South Africa's first black president, but maintained close contact until his death in December 2013. Madikizela Mandela stood shoulder to shoulder with Mandela's widow, Graca Michelle, through most of his funeral proceedings, including his family-only burial ceremony in his rural hometown of Kunu. Then, in February, Madikizela Mandela staked a claim in court for Mandela's modest Kunu home, which he had left to the family trust. In her claim, she said that the tribal authority gave her the property while her husband was in prison and, in an interesting twist, claimed she was entitled to the home because she was still married to him. Although a judge granted a formal divorce after a messy court case in which Mr. Mandela accused his wife of infidelity, the former Mrs. Mandela said that divorce only applied to their civil union. In her court claim, she said the couple's 1958 marriage, done under customary law, had never been dissolved. The court dismissed her claim in April, but Moseneke said executors are still trying to legally resolve the dispute. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
And from Washington, this is VOA.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock on the Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
Take your pick. Watch on television, log on to the internet, or listen right here on the radio. Hello, I am Shaka Sali, the host of Straight Talk Africa from the Voice of America. Each Wednesday night, I'll put you in touch with newsmakers and experts as they, you and I, talk about the most important social and political issues in Africa. Shaka Sali saying, I'll be waiting for your call Wednesday night on Straight Talk Africa from the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. We turn now to U.S. politics, where the unpopularity of presumptive Republican Party presidential nominee Donald Trump and Democratic frontrunner Hillary Clinton is causing an unprecedented level of excitement for a third party known as the Libertarians, the consistent third-place finishers in the otherwise two-party race. At the Libertarian Party convention this weekend in Orlando, they chose former New Mexico Governor Gary Johnson as their presidential candidate. Former Massachusetts Governor William Weld is his vice presidential running mate. Both were very popular governors. And a few polls are showing them favorably up against the Democrats and the Republicans nationwide.
Mm-hmm.
Today is Memorial Day in the United States, and it's always celebrated on the last Monday in May, remembering the men and women who have died while serving in the U.S. military. Since 1948, at Arlington National Cemetery, just outside Washington, soldiers from the so-called Old Guard have placed a flag at each headstone of a fallen member of the armed services. Today, that's more than 230,000 graves. Here is U.S. Army Sergeant Marisol Riley.
I guess it warms your heart to be able to do this for them and to honor them. And I think it's something that everyone should get to experience.
The Memorial Day tradition of placing the flags also is about remembering all who have served in the armed services. Sean Hackshaw is a sergeant in the U.S. Army.
It's all about the soldiers from the past, specifically, especially placing each flag in front of each stone and definitely saluting each soldier for what they've done for us.
But to many of these soldiers, this ceremony is more than a memory of the distant past. It is a reminder of friends and family lost in the line of duty. Alicia Foy is an Army sergeant.
I have friends in the cemetery, leaders in the cemetery. I'm in battle buddies that I went through basic training with that are buried here. And so for me to be able to go and put a flag in front of their grave is a great honor and privilege because they made the ultimate sacrifice for me.
The flag placing ceremony at Arlington Cemetery is followed by the changing of the guard at the Tomb of the Unknowns, the hallowed ground in this already hallowed place. And for the friends and families here remembering those they'll never see again, it is a way to say goodbye and thank you for the sacrifice that loved ones made. VOA's Arash Arabasadi wrote this report. Another important event during the Memorial Day remembrance also takes place here in Washington. It's called Rolling Thunder. Thousands of military veterans, family members, and their supporters drove their motorcycles through the city. It is a popular topic on social media as the bikers draw attention to the many American armed service members who are prisoners of war and those who are listed as missing in action. My colleague Michael Lippin was out among those watching Rolling Thunder on Sunday and joins us now with what he saw. Hey, Michael.
Hi, Steve. Well, you know, I've been watching Rolling Thunder from the street for several years now because it's very convenient. The motorcycle procession actually passes along Independence Avenue, which is right outside the VOA building, as you know. And,
right. You
know, we can even see it through the window from our desks, right?
That's it.
It was a sunny afternoon for this year's event, and I thought, why not try something different? So I took my phone along and I did a live video stream of the Rolling Thunder bikers on our VOA Now Facebook page. Well, here are some of the sounds from that live stream.
Wow. That sounded like a train.
Well, that was me obviously reacting to a really loud horn that came not from a motorcycle, but from one of the trucks in the procession.
Trucks.
As for the bikers, they were in great spirits. They were waving their hands at the spectators lining the street and even high-fiving some of them, including myself. I couldn't resist, you know. Quite a few of the riders had American flags flying from the backs of their bikes, as well as other flags honoring U.S. military personnel who were missing in action or prisoners of war.
So what kind of response, Michael, did your video stream get?
Well, in the 3 hours since we posted the video, it's had 3,000 views,
wow.
600 likes and other responses, and more than 70 shares.
My goodness.
It's also had comments like this one from Yuriko Chinico, who says, "Very sad not to be joining the Rolling Thunder event." Facebook user Sopal says, "I hope one day this will come along in Cambodia."
Wow, that'd be something.
Right. I don't know if they've ever had it there. And this from user Esperitel Excalibur Wallakira. He simply says, "Magnificent."
Mm.
Well, hashtag Rolling Thunder was also popular on Twitter today. The U.S. Department of Defense used it, saying, "Hashtag Rolling Thunder rode through D.C., paying tribute to fallen service members." It also added the hashtags Memorial Day, Grateful Nation, and Honor Them. Well, even presumptive Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump got involved with Rolling Thunder today. He gave a speech to several thousand of the bikers and other supporters by the Lincoln Memorial. His appearance also got a lot of attention on Twitter, with various news sites tweeting photos and video clips of Trump's remarks, which, you know, touched on a lot of the same campaign themes that he's been using lately, including his promise to rebuild the U.S. military and take care of veterans. Steve?
Very good. Thank you so much, Michael. That is VOA's Michael Lippin. You know, you can find Michael on Twitter at Michael_Lippin. I'm there as well at VOA Norman. And you can find International Edition on Twitter at VOA_IE.
This is Science in a Minute.
A new study suggests symptoms of multiple sclerosis, an autoimmune disease of the central nervous system, may be reduced with an occasional diet that mimics fasting. The study finds that this diet produces the hormone cortisone, which kills bad immune cells while creating healthy new cells. Part of the study was conducted on mice with an autoimmune disease. Some of the mice were put on the fast-mimicking diet for 3 days, every 7 days, over a 30-day period. The researchers found that the disease symptoms in the mice on the fast-mimicking diet were reduced. 20% of them completely recovered from their autoimmune disease. They also found that this diet stimulates the restoration of myelin, an insulating cover of proteins and fats that protect nerve fibers in the spine and brain that are damaged by autoimmune diseases such as multiple sclerosis. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. You know, the centuries-old Indian music and dance meeting the 21st century sensibilities, all of that thanks to the artist of Nuntana. That's right, the volunteer group performs traditional art forms smoothly integrated with some innovation and tradition. The ensemble celebrated Asian Pacific American Heritage Month with an original dance drama. And VOA's June So caught up with some of the artists at the show, as we hear now from the director of Nuntana, Rishi Das.
Nuntana means innovation in Sanskrit. I named it Nuntana because we can be an ensemble that performs Indian classical music and Indian classical dance without changing the original. But in Nuntana's case, we try to integrate what we see around us. We try to do it in a unique way so that it still fits that traditional Indian classical storytelling with that layer of ballet, modern African drums, Middle Eastern drums, trying to tie cultural arts from all over the world together. Our members have roots in India, many of them. Also, we welcome members from all over the world. We are a 100% volunteer-driven nonprofit organization. But I've seen that with that volunteer spirit, that real pure passion comes. Most of the members have day jobs or are students or PhD programs. I'm actually a technology consultant.
I am a dentist. This instrument is called a tabla. It's an Indian instrument. I started learning when I was about 6 or 7. It's a very unique instrument because it needs very precise pressure and the touch from your hands. So so a lot of the sounds come from different types of fingering techniques. That's what interests me the most. Nutana is a pretty amazing, very talented group. I've played with many groups in the past. The artists, the vocalists, the musicians, the dancers are extremely talented. They've been through a lot of study. They've learned many, many years of music, and that's what makes it amazing.
I work for non-profit organizations in cultural policy. I've been dancing since I was six, and I've been training in classical South Indian dance called Bharatanatyam. I really find dance to be something that's very enriching. It's something that's very enriching to be another person or to express other emotions or to engage with other people in that way. Is it really brings about different experiences into one's life.
I thought the show was amazing. It was beautiful. I haven't seen much Indian dance and music in the Washington, D.C. area, so I was very excited to see that here tonight.
My ultimate goal with Nutana is that we are able to nourish the D.C. area with not just Indian culture, but a modern representation of it.
Indeed, that was Rishi Das in his own words. As I said earlier, he is the director of Nutana. That report was written and produced by our very own Ju So. It was excellent. You should check out that troupe if they're ever near you. I'm sorry I missed them when they were here in Washington. Hey, listen, thanks everyone for joining us here on this Memorial Day in the United States. Joining us here on the Voice of America for International Edition, always good to have you with us. A reminder, the top world news is straight ahead. We hope you'll stay tuned for that. And for our director, Tracy Carter, our engineer, Chaz Hall, I am Steve Norman. We're all in Washington. Wishing you a great Monday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Vital blood service for millions of Ethiopians will improve thanks to a new cooperative effort between the United States and Ethiopia. Ethiopian Minister of Health, Dr. Ketesa Birhan Admasu, and USAID Ethiopia Mission Director Dennis Weller recently led a groundbreaking ceremony in Addis Ababa to kick off construction for the National Blood Transfusion Service Center. The new center will provide the Ministry of Health with additional capacity to receive donations, screen and process blood products, and distribute life-saving products to serve approximately 26 million Ethiopians. The 5,300 square meter facility will house the administrative headquarters for blood transfusion services, providing a permanent home for offices, training, meetings, and document storage. One of the primary reasons for strengthening and expanding blood transfusion services in Ethiopia is to reduce the prevalence of HIV in the blood supply. The new center will enable the staff to properly screen blood for HIV and other infections after it is collected. Speaking at the event, Mr. Weller said a key reason for improving blood transfusion services in Ethiopia is to reduce the number of maternal deaths. Hemorrhaging continues to be one of the leading causes of maternal mortality in Ethiopia, and many of these deaths can be prevented through blood transfusions. Mr. Weller commended the Ministry of Health's contributions to the many months of planning, design, and the beginning of the construction of the new National Blood Transfusion Service Center. The capacity of this facility will enable the ministry to meet more than 25% of the World Health Organization's recommended annual blood collection goals for Ethiopia. Additionally, the center will oversee the distribution of blood products, which will expand access to blood transfusion services throughout rural and urban areas of Ethiopia. The $5 million construction cost is funded by the U.S. President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, or PEPFAR. USAID is expected to complete construction of the facility in 2 years. The United States is proud to work with its longtime partner, Ethiopia, to help improve this and other health services for the people of Ethiopia.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.